You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get an update in an ongoing investigation into electrical fires caused by low-quality wiring in some rental properties. Now, a lot of people have been reporting weirder-than-usual dreams during the pandemic. Now, you might counter that dreams are known for being weird, but actually research shows that most of our dreams are pretty boring, mirroring what happens in our day-to-day lives. So these extra weird pandemic dreams are out of the ordinary. A new theory says that the bizarre dreams might actually serve a purpose, helping our brains learn better. Jim Davies is a professor of cognitive science at Carleton University in Canada who studies dreams and wrote a book on imagination. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Nice to be here.
So dreaming, is it just random stuff or do we think it serves a purpose?
Oh, God. Nobody knows. You know, it's hard to... everybody dreams and, you know, almost every animal dreams even. And so to say that it has no purpose is probably wrong, mm-hmm. but you know, we don't really know what that purpose is.
Is this a thing? People's dreams have been getting weirder during the pandemic?
Yeah, there've been reports of that. And it's not really clear why. I mean, there is a theory that has an explanation for why. But it's a very new theory, and I just should say at the outset that one of the really cool things about dream research is that nobody agrees on anything. the theories, like, we don't really know how dreams are made, what they're for, why they are the way they are. We have some very interesting theories, but there is no scientific consensus on what's right. And there are going to be some breakthroughs coming. Hopefully in the next 30 years or so.
I want to check out that theory. You wrote about it online. Tell us about this idea of why we might have extra dreams when our lives are, you know, sort of boring and not that interesting.
Right. So as you mentioned in your introduction there, most dreams are pretty boring. And the reason they don't seem that way is because we don't tend to think about them very much when they're boring. But when you carefully study the content of dreams, and you do that by putting them in a sleep lab and waking them up periodically and say, hey, what were you dreaming? A lot of them are just like, I was waiting in line. I was like trying to organize cards. You know, the reason we think they're weird is because we tend to think about and repeat and tell people about the weird dreams, right? So I had a dream once that I went to a guy's funeral and all of his toes were in little tiny coffins. Now I've told that dream to people like 50 times. So of course I remember it really well. And I don't remember the boring dream I had of just, you know, running away from some scary guy. But we do have bizarre dreams once in a while, right? And what's curious is that we don't really notice, most of the time, we don't notice that they're bizarre while they're happening, right? So these are just some of the facts about dreams that the theories have to contend with.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, this new theory of dreaming, it says that that we do dream about weird and unusual things to keep us from doing something called overlearning. And overlearning is a concept from the new wave of artificial intelligence called deep learning, which is basically when you give a neural network a lot of data, if you let it run too long, it will overlearn, which means that it will basically memorize the training set and it won't generalize very well when you give it something new, right? It's almost as if you teach somebody to recognize a Macintosh by looking at a bunch of Macintoshes that have a scratch on it. And it comes to think that if it doesn't have that scratch, it's not a Macintosh, right? That's kind of what it's like. So the idea is that similar to the way we deal with this problem in artificial intelligence, that your mind is creating unusual things you have never and probably never will see to keep your mind from getting a little too crystallized and overlearning what you've experienced during the day.
So it gives us practice dealing with different stuff.
Yeah. And the practice theory of dreaming is in several other theories too, that we're practicing for dangerous situations or we're practicing for social situations in a safe environment to do so. But those dreams kind of rely on dreams being realistic. This new theory actually is the first that has a reason why they're sometimes weird.
I want to ask about how hard it is to study dreams. Because I know when I am waking up from a dream, there's probably a period where I'm full on dreaming and then I'm halfway awake and trying to make sense of the dream. So I don't know, by the time I'm awake and telling you about my dream, it might not resemble that original dream that much at all. How do you sort that out?
It's a huge problem, right? And the reason, it's very hard to study and mostly because it's expensive. You have to have a sleep lab. You have to hire people to stay in the sleep lab all night, like scientists and participants. You got to wake them up constantly and ask them what they're dreaming. And even when you do that, you know, by the time you've said two sentences, you've forgotten a lot of the dream, right? So it's very, very hard to study dreams. There's also just not a whole lot of interest in it. I mean, it's something that people love to talk about. Every time I give a talk on imagination, half the questions are about dreams. But scientists are not super interested in it. There are a few people doing some really great work. So yeah, it's expensive. It's difficult. It's difficult to measure. And it's like, so, I mean, you could dream about somebody you haven't even thought about in 15 years. So, you know, trying to come up with a theory of dreaming that applies to everybody when we don't even, you know, it seems like sometimes the things you dream are so idiosyncratic to the way you are that, you know, psychology is about coming up with theories that apply to everybody. And it's just been proving very hard to do that.
But a few minutes ago, you said you're hoping to see some big breakthroughs in the not too distant future. Given what you just said, why are you hopeful?
I'm probably unrealistically optimistic, to be honest with you. But, you know, we're increasing the number of scientists, right? And I think dreaming, there are a whole bunch of things in psychology that used to be kind of taboo that are now less taboo. Creativity, consciousness, love, dreaming. A lot of these things are now respectable research areas. And as new people enter the field, they're going to feel, welcome to study those things. So I'm really hoping that there'll be more research on it. I mean, given that we spend a third of our time sleeping,
yeah,
it's amazing how little research and how little we understand sleep and dreaming.
Well, now you had Freud, right? He spent a lot of time thinking about dreams in a very particular way. I don't know, why did we fall? Is it his fault? Did we fall out of love with dreams because of Freud? Or why did we stop studying it?
That's an interesting question. I don't really know if that's the case. I know that Freud, for scientific psychology, he made a lot of things taboo because he wasn't really a scientist. Like he was a theoretician and he came up with a lot of very interesting ideas and he's a great writer. And he captured the public attention and a lot of intellectuals at the time, but scientific psychology sort of left him behind. So, you know, even though he's had a very big influence, particularly on the value of the unconscious, that's an interesting idea I've never really thought of before, that maybe Freud's emphasis on dreams has made it taboo. It could be.
Do you have any advice as you leave us for how we can, I don't know, think about our own dreams? And even if we can't figure out why they're there, maybe use them to inspire our own creativity and imagination?
Well, I think a really exciting thing is if you can have a lucid dream, which is where you sort of are aware in your dream that you are dreaming. And that's very hard to do, but there are things you can practice to try to make it happen. None of them work very well, I'll just say out front. But one of the things that I like is if you see some text, you look away and you look back, does the text say the same thing? So one of the reliable things about dreams is that text tends to change and technology doesn't work super well. So if you look at your watch or whatever, so if you just make a practice during the day, if you see a street sign, you look away, look back. Is it the same street? If it is, you're not dreaming. That might seem a little bit silly, but the idea is you get into a habit of that. And then in your dream, if you do it, you'll suddenly realize you're dreaming, you'll go lucid. And once you do that, you can explore fantasies, you can fly around, you can practice basketball, and then it'll work. Like practicing things in your dreams has proven to improve your performance in real life.
I'm so going to try that, Jim. Thanks for joining us today.
You're so welcome.
Jim Davies is a professor of cognitive science at Carleton University in Canada and author of the book Imagination. He talked to us about what might be causing weird pandemic dreams and the function they might serve. Producers, if you really want to mess with me, keep changing the script on my screen here so every time I look away it's different. Then I'll think I'm dreaming. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a question about the holiday cocktail known as the Tom and Jerry.
Every season has its cocktails. In the summer, it's gin and tonic with a twist of lime, a margarita, or a Long Island iced tea. When the temperature drops and the snow piles up, people want a little more warmth, like a hot buttered rum or spiced mulled wine. During the holiday season, folks in Wisconsin turn to a hot drink known as the Tom and Jerry to warm them up. That got listener Pam Stokowski of Whitewater wondering.
Is Tom and Jerry's a Wisconsin thing?
We were intrigued and decided this topic needed some serious research. So we asked someone who has spent some time studying the cocktail.
Down on the corner, the crowd is so merry. I wind up by having about 12 Tom and Jerry.
Well, maybe someone who has a slightly more scholarly approach.
My name is Jim Drager. I wrote a book for the Wisconsin Historical Society called Bottoms Up, A Toast to Wisconsin's Historic Bars and Breweries.
We thought Drager might know if the Tom and Jerry is unique to Wisconsin and why that's so.
I think there are a couple of reasons why it's a Wisconsin thing. First of all, it's basically a farm-based drink because it has dairy and eggs in it and butter in it. So, you know, for us Wisconsinites, that hits home to that sweet spot in our heart for dairy. And I think the other reason is because it's a drink that has brandy in it. And as we all know, Wisconsin has a thing for brandy.
So we have a dairy connection and the Scotty favorite brandy. But did the Tom and Jerry originate here, or does it come from somewhere else?
There is an American mixologist named Jerry Thomas who claimed credit for it in the 1860s. He published a recipe for it in the first cocktail book written in the United States, but historians have demonstrated that was around before Jerry got his hands on it. There's actually a known origin for it. In the 1820s, a London playwright created the drink to popularize a play that he had written that had two characters named Tom and Jerry in them. And it just took off from that point and became popular.
The play was called Tom and Jerry, or Life in London, by William Moncrief. It was quite popular at the time, running for over 2 years in London before coming to America. The Domino Bar in Wausau specializes in making Tom and Jerry's, serving over 4,000 of the hot concoction between Thanksgiving and New Year. Bar owner Dan Bauer is not sure if the Tom and Jerry is a Wisconsin thing or not, but he does say,
I know they're very popular around here, especially when it gets cold. The colder it gets, the better it gets. Warms you up inside.
Bauer says the tradition of making Tom and Jerry's over the holidays started at the Domino sometime in the 80s and gets bigger every year. Bartender Donna Seidler put one together Domino style.
We have the bowl of the Tom and Jerry mix. We do a swoop and spoon of the top secret batter. And then we add a shot of dark rum and brandy. And we have to make sure the water is rapidly boiling. And as we pour that in the cup, give it a couple of stirs. It's nice and frothy on top. Top it off with some of the sprinkles. And that is a Tom and Jerry.
If you can't make it to the Domino during the holiday season, you can make Tom and Jerry's at home. Just don't forget to get a tub of batter from the market.
No, I didn't forget. The tree is up and the Tom and Jerry mix is in the refrigerator.
So gather around the fireplace with your family and friends, light the tree, and enjoy the season.
What'll you have, lad?
Oh, whatever you're having, sir.
I'm having Tom and Jerry myself.
Special thanks to Rob Mentzer for his help with this piece. This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin, in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Coming up, an investigative reporter shares what she's found about electrical fires in Milwaukee and why they disproportionately happen to low-income Black residents. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. An ongoing investigation by the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel has found that low-income Black residents of Milwaukee are 5 times more likely to experience life-threatening electrical fires in their homes than anywhere else in the city. Reporters found that in spite of safety violations, property owners in Milwaukee have continued to receive federal rent assistance, putting renters in danger. Daphne Chen is a data and investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel who's been working on this electrical safety story. Daphne, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've talked to one of your colleagues on this investigation in the past. Can you remind us how concentrated this faulty wiring problem is and who is at risk from it?
Absolutely. We started looking at the issue of electrical fires, not even thinking that there was going to be so many racial disparities. But when we started analyzing the data, we found that the highest concentration is in our Black and brown neighborhoods. So as an example, 53206, which is on the north side, had a rate of suspected electrical fires that was 5 times the average in the rest of the city. And so that's a big disparity that we wanted to dive into.
In a new piece on this, one of your big findings is that Milwaukee properties with electrical violations, reported violations, continue to receive rental assistance. So in effect, tax funding. Can you talk about how that works and why that problem isn't getting fixed despite that?
Absolutely. So, you know, rent assistance, whether it's the regular kind of rent assistance that HUD was giving out, or it's the emergency rent assistance given out during the pandemic, it's supposed to help renters, but it helps landlords too. And actually, those checks go directly to landlords. So for this latest installment, we compared rent assistance data with code violation data. And we found hundreds of thousands of dollars of rent assistance going to property owners that had electrical violations on file with the city that were outstanding at the time. And that's just in the last couple of years. And that's just with a small sample of data we were able to get through public records requests. If you look at, you know, the full amount of data, or if you look at all types of code violations, not just electrical, the numbers are going to be a lot, lot higher.
People might hear that and say, wait a minute, these are electrical violations that have been reported to the city. Action has been ordered in these properties. Why aren't they ending up getting fixed?
Yeah, the inspection program in Milwaukee just doesn't have a lot of follow through. Landlords are given a really long time to come into compliance. Things lapse, especially if a tenant moves out or is evicted. These violations can just kind of flounder. And so in addition to that, there are a lot of state laws that make it hard to enforce code violation rules at a really strong level. So high fines, having pre-inspections before renters move into a home, those things are made really difficult by state law. And so the fact is that in Milwaukee, renter protections are just not very high.
And there's another level here. Sometimes community groups are the ones responsible for distributing, you write, that federal money. You and your colleagues talked to them. What did they say about their ability, their resources to follow up on whether the buildings that are getting this money are risky?
Yeah, so the money usually flows from the federal government to the local level. And then sometimes there are local nonprofits like Community Advocates or SDC that help officials distribute this money. But, you know, a lot of them said, we just don't do checks with this pandemic assistance money. It's just not really in their scope of work. And, you know, everybody is kind of overworked and underfunded in this area. And at the same time, there is another type of rent assistance, which is the HUD, also known as Section 8 rent assistance, that does have more regulations on it. Inspections are supposed to be done by the housing authorities. But in those cases, a lot of those inspections are really limited to what's visible. So an inspector isn't going to move a couch. They're not going to plug in an outlet tester into the outlets to make sure that the wiring is done correctly. It's just not what they do. And so this kind of problem continues to churn along.
Can you talk about some of the hazards renters in Milwaukee have faced because of unsafe wiring?
Absolutely. It's so sad because the reality is that electrical fires are more deadly than other types of fires, but they're also really preventable. And so we're talking about renters who, worst case scenario, have been trapped in fires and passed away. But even if they're lucky enough to escape with their lives, it's just a hugely traumatic event. We've talked to renters who have lost all of their belongings, been displaced, become homeless, you know, looking for emergency housing and kind of just having to take the next thing that they can get, which may also have serious electrical problems. So it's a cycle that continues to really fall hardest on our Black and Brown neighbors. And it can be just really, really traumatizing.
And one interesting, puzzling side note here is, in the communities with a lot of low-income people, there's not a lot of affordable housing. Rents aren't necessarily that much cheaper in these lower-income neighborhoods, so there may not be a place to move out to if you're worried about the wiring in your current rental.
Absolutely. It's kind of a phenomenon that housing experts have known about in Milwaukee and have been researching. The rents really don't vary much across Milwaukee, which seems counterintuitive. But it makes a lot of sense when you look at how segregated Milwaukee is, how much the housing stock is sort of aging, how few renter protections there are. And you see that there are a class of landlords who kind of specialize in people who may not have a high income, may have evictions and credit scores on their records, and can't necessarily just rent from anybody because of these things on their background. And they may have to just accept the best quality of home that they can get. You know, there are a couple studies out there that have shown that not just in Milwaukee, but in other cities, landlords in poorer areas of town actually can make more of a profit than those in wealthier areas.
In just our last half a minute or so, what unanswered questions are you still trying to figure out here with this faulty wiring story?
We're still trying to figure out from city officials and from state officials what they think should be done. You know, a lot of city officials have said their hands are tied by state law. But at the same time, there are housing advocates and experts who say there are solutions that can be explored, such as rent abatement programs or, you know, strengthening inspection programs to better protect renters. So that's the next installment we're looking forward to.
Daphne, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Daphne Chen is a data investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She talks about her work looking into electrical safety violations in low-income, primarily Black Milwaukee neighborhoods. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, explore some of the legendary locations from ancient history with the author of the new National Geographic book called Lost Cities, Ancient Tombs. And get a look at the year's best new movies and let us know if you saw them at a theater or you streamed them at home. Reggie the Real Critic is back with us with some great recommendations. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a new study shows that more than half of young U.S. adults are overweight or obese. We'll look at what's driving America's obesity crisis, potential health problems with being overweight, and how we can be a healthier society. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, an expert on public shootings tells us about the challenges facing school districts when they respond to threats of violence that come from social media platforms. Now, a new study is highlighting the ongoing obesity epidemic in the United States. According to researchers at Johns Hopkins University, more than half of people between the ages of 18 and 25 are either overweight or obese. Some other findings: back in the late 1970s, 18% of people in that age group were considered overweight. Now it's 24%. But the really eye-opening part has to do with obesity. Back then, only 6% were obese. Today, that number, 33%. That weight can put people at risk for certain health problems, including serious complications from COVID-19. So how did we get here? What would it take to turn things around? You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is behind the increase in overweight and obesity here in the United States? Do you see solutions out there? Is this something that's affected your life personally? Have you worked to lose weight? It is a challenge. We all know that. How has it gone for you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Alejandra Ellison Barnes is an assistant professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. She worked on this obesity study. Dr. Ellison Barnes, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, we've heard that we're getting heavier as a country. Were these results of your study a surprise to you?
So you're right. We've known from other studies that obesity rates have been rising in all age groups. So it was not a surprise at all to find that they have risen among those who are age 18 to 25. However, we actually were surprised by the magnitude, you know, to find that now the average, you know, the mean weight of an individual 18 through 25 now falls in the overweight range was surprising. And really just the magnitude of the increase that we saw in obesity was I think important to take note of.
Can you talk about why you focused on this 18 to 25 age range, a pivotal age of life for a lot of people?
Yeah, so, you know, emerging adulthood is a really unique developmental stage. This is the time when people are leaving home, you know, potentially living on their own for the first time, either going to college or entering the workforce, or perhaps, you know, going to school and then entering the workforce. They're, you know, in new relationships, both social and romantic. It's a time of immense change. And ultimately, at the end of that period, people kind of have their adult identity somewhat formed. So the habits that are developed in this emerging adult period often stick with people through the rest of their life. So we really see it as a time when there's both the sort of increased risk of developing obesity, and also it's, you know, a potential period to intervene and prevent that from happening, to prevent the long-term health consequences of obesity.
And as I understand
it, that's why we wanted to see what's been going on.
Sure. As I understand it from the Johns Hopkins press release on this, part of your worry is that we don't study this age group and obesity trends maybe as much as we should. Why is that?
Exactly. So often, you know, we think about children, we think about adolescents, and then we think about adults. And this age group, this 18 to 25 group, often gets bunched in with either adolescents, which often extends, you know, the definitions often extend into the early 20s, or young adults, which the definition of young adults is totally variable depending on what you're looking at, but can extend up into, you know, nearly 40 years of age. And so, you know, I think 18-year-olds are very different from 40-year-olds. 11-year-olds or, you know, 12-year-olds who are adolescents are very different from 25-year-olds. So looking at this period, you know, by itself is something that I think is not done enough.
We're talking to Dr. Alejandra Ellison Barnes from the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, looking at new research she was part of, finding substantial increases for young adults, 18 to 25-year-olds, when it comes to being overweight and especially obesity. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions about the study, maybe your own experience at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Ellison Barnes, can you talk about some of the health risks, short and long term, that we associate with obesity in particular?
Sure. So we know that obesity is associated with a number of long-term health problems. These include hypertension or high blood pressure, which long-term can lead to heart disease, stroke, kidney disease, diabetes, which also in turn can lead to heart disease, stroke, kidney disease, as well as eye problems, nerve damage, chronic pain, fatty liver, which can eventually progress to cirrhosis and ultimately liver failure, sleep apnea, arthritis due to stress on the joints. Some types of cancer are more likely in the context of obesity. And then psychological issues as well. So low self-esteem, social exclusion, anxiety and depression. We also see, you know, a lot of absenteeism, school academic issues, which can affect kind of long-term life outcomes. And so, you know, the array of health problems that we know are associated with obesity is quite broad.
Now, you used BMI, body mass index, as kind of your measure of overweight and obesity. Can you talk about what that is and how it works as a measurement?
Sure. So BMI is a measure that looks at how much a person weighs compared to how tall they are. And the specific formula to calculate it is the weight in kilograms divided by the height in meter squared. You're welcome to do that for yourself on paper, or there's plenty of calculators available if you Google. The CDC and the NIH both have BMI calculators. And BMI helps us, you know, thinking on a population level or for research, to get an understanding of where things stand at a population level from a weight perspective. And on an individual level, it's I think useful in like the medical context to get an idea of how, you know, where someone's weight falls. It's a little bit less useful on the individual level in the sense that the BMI measure can't differentiate muscle and fat. It underpredicts risk in certain ethnicities, things like that. So certainly I think it's a good way to get a sense of what's going on, but isn't always, it's not always 100% reliable on the individual level.
Right. I understand if you're a football player, your BMI might look high, but that doesn't mean you're overweight or obese. That's the problem at the individual level. On average, though,
exactly.
We know that most of us aren't football players.
Correct. Exactly. Which is why on a population level, it gives us a good idea of where population weight as a whole stands.
Now, what do you look at for causes? This is going on, this increase at a population level. I know a lot of people struggle with weight at an individual level. Is this just lots of us are making health choices that are leading to this? Or do you look for underlying changes in how, I don't know what are you looking at for causes?
Oh, so I wish I had an easy, you know, one-line right. answer for you here, but
everybody
I don't.
Does, I think.
Yeah, obesity is really, you know, truly a multifactorial disease. And I think there really isn't one reason that accounts for the changes that we've seen in obesity rates over time. The things that we think about are, yes, there have been changes in diet, which, you know, at an individual level might be related to choices and, you know, what people choose to eat. However, this is influenced by the marketing of unhealthy foods, the easy availability in the food environment of calorie-dense fast food and processed food, limited access to fresh foods in certain neighborhoods. And then on the other side, physical activity. Many jobs now are requiring less physical activity than in the past. We are, as a society, we're very reliant on cars to get around. We don't, you know, we don't necessarily do a lot of walking. There has been a huge increase in screen time, you know, not only TV, but computers and cell phones and tablets. And so these are playing a role, but then there's also factors that I think are talked about less, things like decreased sleep duration, stress, environmental exposures, and all of these factors interact at the individual level with, you know, one given person's biological and genetic kind of predisposition to obesity. So I think, yes, there are individual factors, but there's also these broad kind of societal factors that are playing a role as well. And I don't think that, you know, any one of these can be pointed to as the sole culprit. It's really a very complex interplay of factors that's led to these changing rates over time.
We're talking about rising levels of obesity in the United States with Dr. Alejandra Ellison Barnes, assistant professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, co-author of a new study on the levels of obesity among younger adults. We're talking 18 to 25 in the United States. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think is causing this increase? If you're in this 18 to 25 age group, do you see this as a common problem? Is this a topic of conversation among you and your friends? What would you point toward when it comes to possible solutions? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about obesity in the United States. A new study from Johns Hopkins University shows that over half of people between ages 18 and 25 are overweight or obese. Dr. Alejandra Ellison Barnes is an assistant professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins. She worked on this study, and you can join in with your thoughts, questions, maybe your experiences at 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller now. Carrick is with us in Beaver Dam. Carrick, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
So you guys were talking about BMI earlier, and I'm within that 18 to 25-year-old range. And according to my BMI, I'm obese. But they don't – for me, it doesn't really – BMI doesn't work for me. I played football in high school. I'm an 18-year-old that's 6'3", 230 pounds. So according to BMI, I'm overweight, but I'm a perfectly healthy 18-year-old, haven't had a medical issue in my life. But compared to other high schoolers that I went with that were morbidly obese, compared to what I've seen my grandparents, they showed me pictures of people in the 60s and 70s, and almost nobody was obese back then.
Carrick, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Again, you talked about this, Dr. Ellison Barnes. They're at an individual level, BMI can trick us a little bit. At the population
exactly.
level, it's a little more useful.
Exactly. No, you're a perfect example of where, you know, for someone who is a football player, this might not be the best measure to use.
Thanks for that call, Carrick. But his point, he is seeing in his community, colleagues, fellow students who weren't athletes, who do have that higher BMI that might qualify them for obesity, something that he didn't see, as he said, in his grandparents' generation, that kind of matches the data you've collected.
Exactly. I mean, the rise that we've seen over the last several decades is stunning.
Thanks for the call, Carrick. We'll go to Chris now in Kenosha. Hi, Chris.
Hi there. Thank you. I am 52 years old, and let me tell you, in the 80s, when my friends and I were teenagers, we obsessed about the same issue. So it's very unfortunate. It has not changed. And my question is, and I feel like it does have to do with activity and with calorie-dense foods, But let me tell you, none of us played computer games, and we were all fixated and obsessed about body image and weight. And the fact that it's only gotten worse is very sad, because it's so overwhelming to the mind and mental health. But my question is, what do you think about additives in food in terms of the vitamins? This has so many vitamins in it, and this has so many vitamins added to it, as though it's supposed to be healthy. But do you think there's anything about the lack of nutrients with infants, to the mother in the womb, and how it affects the metabolism later on? Could that be something happening? There has to be something going on.
I gotcha. Thanks a lot, Dr. Allison Barnes. She's worried about food today being different than it was. I don't know. There's a lot of bad stuff when I was a kid in the 80s, too. But is there something different about our food system now?
So I think as a whole, there's a lot of processed foods that are, easily available, high calorie processed foods that honestly are, often more affordable than some of the healthier choices. And that food has been heavily marketed, particularly to children, and also, certain socioeconomic populations as well. And so I think it's true that the overall food environment has changed, and really the easy availability of calories is something that's increased over time.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Julia joins us next in Madison. Julia, hi.
Hi, I'm a social psychologist, and I think part of the problem is that this is one of the last groups that we can stigmatize against in the United States, and as a result, we hold people individually responsible for it, and then it prevents people from exercising, getting treatment, having honest conversations with their doctors. I think we'd be better off if we stopped stigmatizing people for their obesity and looked at the multifactorial nature of where this problem comes from.
Julia, thanks a lot for the call. And Dr. Allison Barnes, that concern about stigma and shame not being a great solution at the individual level for obesity.
Yeah, and I think that's why, when we were talking about factors that have played into this increase, I was trying to stress that, yes, there are individual factors, but so much of this is informed by what's happening in the social and structural environment in our society. And, for an individual to sort of go against that flow is very challenging. Speaking as a primary care physician, I'm not a weight management specialist. I'm a primary care physician. And when I'm talking to my patients about obesity, no matter what their BMI, I really try to have my patients focus on healthy behaviors rather than the numbers. I'm less concerned if your BMI is 24 or 26. I'm concerned with, what kind of diet are you eating? Are you incorporating fruits, vegetables, whole grains, nuts into your diet? Are you avoiding added sugars, healthy processed food, highly processed foods? Are you getting physical activity? Most of us really don't get enough, myself included. Are you trying to reduce stress in your life where it's possible and get adequate sleep? And so really focusing on living your best healthy life rather than on the weight. And because it's true that there is a lot of stigma associated with obesity. And as the caller said, that doesn't help anybody in terms of addressing this.
Thanks for that call. And just our last minute, that sounds like pretty good universal advice, the handful of things, dealing with stress, dealing with better nutrition, getting more activity. Do you think we could turn around this bigger problem that you're tracking in your research by all of us taking those simpler messages and not worrying about, like you said, the numbers?
I don't know. I think that if on the individual level, if we all, move toward that, I think that it would make a big difference. I do think that we need to sort of think about things at a broader society and policy level as well, increasing access to and affordability of healthy food, encouraging built environments that are actually conducive to physical activity. All of this can't happen on the individual level. It's just not enough.
Dr. Allison Barnes, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Alejandra Ellison Barnes is an assistant professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. We talked to her today about the United States obesity epidemic, including a new study she worked on showing more than half of young U.S. adults, talking ages 18 to 25, there are overweight or obese. In the third year that schools are trying to figure out how to keep kids safe from COVID-19 in the classroom, some schools have decided to leave the classroom behind. Madeline Fox went into the Kickapoo Valley Forest in Lafarge to a school that's outside all year round.
Students and staff start their morning with a song. The key to holding class outside all year in a state where it regularly drops well below freezing is clothing, specifically layers, as demonstrated by 5-year-old Mia Scher.
I have this coat under this coat, and that's this.
Mia is one of 29 students in pre-K and kindergarten at the Kickapoo Valley Forest School, a public charter school in the Lafarge School District. She and her classmates are outside pretty much all day, every day.
When some of the children arrived here on day one, I don't think they really, of course, knew what they were getting into. And there were children saying, like, when are we going inside?
That's Jonelle Kisa, education director at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve.
And we were able to say, well, we're not. We're going to play outside all day. And now they don't even ask anymore. They just love to be outside.
For the last few years, the Kickapoo Valley Forest School only did a half-day educational program on Fridays. This is its first year of being on a regular school's 5-day regular length school day schedule. The 5-day school was in the works before COVID-19 hit, but Kisa says the pandemic gave it a little push.
We really had people saying, like, gosh, we want our kids to gather, we want them to have social experiences, but we want them to do it outside where it's safe.
In some ways, outdoor school is a lot like indoor school.
The teachers will often bring learning materials, whether it's math or reading, out into the forest, set up a blanket or a rug, and sit with small groups of children to do instruction.
Jason Rood went into teaching as a second career after he saw few male teachers when his own kids started school. He convinced his teaching program to let him do his hands-on experience at the Kickapoo Valley Forest School, where he's one of the teachers who work with kids on their letters and numbers.
Ooh, this one I think is in your name.
I'm listening to these guys.
E. E, and how does the E sound in your name?
E.
Eh.
School outdoors also has some key differences from more traditional schools. Most days, the kids walk close to 2 miles, hiking through the forest preserve. One week, they gathered walnut hulls and then spent a morning cooking those walnuts down over their fire pit into dye. They brought white T-shirts, and teacher Jimena Puig helped them use an evergreen branch to sprinkle the dye into patterns on their shirt.
If it gets on your snow pants, honey, it will dye your snow pants too. So.
Puig is one of the teachers who helped shape the forest school's curriculum last year while they were planning for full-time students. She says the outdoor time is good for the kids to get their energy out and learn through interactive play, but it's also good for the future for everyone.
The love that they start to develop for their environment, which is critical for our survival as human beings, that our children come to love and appreciate and care for the environment around them. That is happening because we're out in it.
The Kickapoo Valley Forest School's default is to be outside all day, except nap time, rain, snow, or sun, unless it's so cold that prolonged outside time would be too dangerous. But traditionally, indoor schools have also had some success adding outdoor time, like the Lacouture Ojibwe School in Hayward. Mary Robinson teaches Ojibwe language to grades 9 through 12, which she says works well outside because it's first and foremost a spoken language that can be spoken anywhere.
Especially for Native students, it's really important for all of us to be connected still to the earth and the environment and the outdoors, and we've lost a lot of that by coming inside.
She started taking her students outside last spring after the school brought students back in person, and continued this fall.
We still will go outside occasionally when it's chilly out. We haven't been doing it as much lately because high school students don't like to wear coats and boots very much.
Even if she can't bring her teenagers out as much as she'd like, Robinson is part of a trend of schools and families that got their kids outside because of COVID-19, but see it lasting past the pandemic. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio, a fake social media trend brought fake threats of violence to schools around the country, leading some to close on Friday. We'll learn more about how school districts evaluate threats, even vague threats, and the best ways to keep kids safe at schools. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.